Leon asked me to talk about time. Leon is off on alone time, so he'll miss this. The thing that really interests me or draws me back to the psychedelic experience again and again is the notion that there's something that you can learn that would somehow be have an impact on society at large, that when you have the psychedelic experience, it's like you're a sailor on some kind of a vast ocean where you let down your net into the deeps, and the hope is that you will snare an idea of some sort and of some size. And it may be, you know, that you come up with the equivalent of tuna, which is many small ideas, and perhaps you bring up your nets and see that they have just been shredded by something so large that you scarcely care to imagine it. But the hope is to land an idea of intermediate size that you can then fully explore and understand. When you go into that ocean as a swimmer, you see these things passing in review, things of such beauty and intricacy and complexity that you are literally speechless, and even speechless in terms of an interior dialogue about what you're seeing. You can't, it just blows your mind and washes past you in such profusion that there seems to be, the notion of capturing it seems to be like the notion of a child emptying the ocean with a cup. But if you have a net, and I'm not sure what a net is exactly, but it's a way of somehow capturing these psychedelic ideas and then bringing them back for examination. And I think part of it rests on a technique of cyclical recitation to yourself of what you've seen, so that you carry a vision to a level of reflection in memory as you pull away from it. And then 10 minutes later, you tell yourself again what has just happened. And then 20 minutes later again, so that you get a series of telescoping images which are granted a compression of the original event, but nevertheless, they bear the stamp of what the thing was. So the thing of this class that has happened to me is a very peculiar idea about time, which was developed fairly suddenly, as I would imagine ideas develop in me in the early and mid 70s, and then it was pretty much formulated in my head, but it took the invention of small computers to make it possible to write software so that I could actually talk to other people about this idea. Well, since we have no computers and not even a blackboard, this will be a kind of feeling-toned excursion into talking about this theory of time. It has an abstract foundation and a practical foundation. Its abstract foundation is the notion that time is different than we have come to conceive of it as the legacy of Western science. The legacy of Western science is that time is duration, that time is a dimension necessary for process. And it's usually thought of as a flat plane against which some other fluctuating variable can be plotted. This is called, you know, linear time. And Newton's physics took the same view of space. The Newtonian view of space was that it was essentially emptiness. It was something which you had to have if you wanted to put something somewhere. So it was a kind of an abstract plenum. But Einstein showed that space is actually some kind of thing. It has properties of thingdom. It is distorted in the presence of a large magnetic field. And so it rose out of the realm of abstraction and then was cognized as an objectifiable entity, a topological manifold that was real. This is, I think, the same step that has to be taken for time. Time is not simply the dimension of duration required for the successive occurrence of occasions. It is rather some kind of conditioned topological manifold. We can think of it as a fluid medium flowing across a surface, a river, in other words. In some places, the river is very broad and shallow and meanders because the pitch of the incline over which it's moving is so slight that it can barely discern which way to move. You see this often in the Amazon. In other situations, the incline increases and the speed of the flow increases and the depth of the channel increases and the sides of the distance between the banks decreases. So time runs slowly and it runs quickly. It has a kind of modulated speed. Well, it's been a commonplace of Western cosmology since Darwin, although it's never been elevated to the status of a law or even a principle, that steady complexification has occurred in the universe since its very beginning, that this is something that we see in the very first moments of physics and proceeding right up into our own day. In other words, in the era before physics, that period of time so short that it's the period of time, it's less than the amount of time necessary for the photon to cross the radius of the nucleus of the atom. There was absolute chaos and a complete absence of physics. And then what sprang into being was a physics of pure electrons, of pure energy. And it was not for many seconds that temperatures fell to a point such that other factors could come into play, such that free electrons could fall into atomic orbitals and this sort of thing. And at each successive level of cooling, new forms of order became possible. At first, everything was just this plasma of particles and energy, and then atomic systems sprang into being. And then at still lower temperatures, these atomic systems were able to form molecular systems. The energy level in the general medium dropped below the level at which it would disrupt the molecular bond. So then molecules came into being. And then at that point, there was the aggregation of stars and the cooking out of the heavier elements through the process of cooking hydrogen so that iron and carbon and these things then arose. And by this time, the universe is much cooler than it was at the beginning. And then finally, you get temperature regimes and environmental situations where very large colloidal molecular species can come into being, large polymerized molecules, and this sets the stage for DNA, which once it emerges, and the thing to notice at each of these stages of complexification is that it requires a shorter time than the processes preceding it. If the universe is, let's take the long view and say 20 billion years old, then the first 10 billion years, not very much happened that was interesting in the realm of complexity. There was star formation and the percolation of heavy chemistry, but not life, and or it's doubtful that life occurred in the early universe. So what we see then is the emergence of more and more complex animal forms at a greater and greater speed, and then finally the emergence of self-reflection in the primates, and then epigenetic methods of encoding information, in other words, writing and storytelling and language. And at each point, what is happening is there's a progressive time binding of energy and a progressive intensification and speed up of the complexification of certain parts of the universe. Right now, the most complex part of the universe that we know is the human brain mind situated in its network of computers and cultural conventions and social obligations and expectations and hopes and fears and historical aspirations, etc. I mean, this is the realm of the densely packed that the Buddhists are talking about. So it seems to me that this should be seen as the operation of a general law, and we are not outside of this. We are, in fact, the cutting edge of it. Somehow, of all the animal species on the earth, the human beings are carriers of this temporal speeding up process, which is now engulfing the entire planet. And so that's the general law, or the general perception upon which this idea I elaborated was based, the notion that complexification is being conserved through time and being built up as some quality that the universe is very interested in maintaining. And then I looked at the I Ching, which I hope is familiar to most of you. I'm sure it probably is. It's a very ancient Chinese oracle system of that uses what are called hexagrams, which are six-leveled ideograms of broken or unbroken lines. And the possible subset of these things is 64, which is an interesting number because it's the number which DNA operates on, because it uses 64 codons. And in fact, I came to see that as no coincidence, that actually life was organized around this number and the I Ching as well, because both were subject to a set of rules which was surfacing in the phenomenon of biological organization and the organization of a Chinese oracular theory for understanding past and future time. And I looked at what is called the sequence, which is the way in which you move from one hexagram to the next, and I sought order there and found order that I think had been lost since pre-Han, perhaps pre-Zhou time. And I came to see the I Ching as we possess it today as an archaeological artifact, a piece of broken machinery. It's like the turbine of a jet plane. You puzzle over it and you see that it could be used for something, and you do use it for things, and it's very effective, but it's really a piece of broken machinery from a very ancient technology which ceased to exist before the rise of the Han Dynasty. And what it was it was like a Taoist technology of understanding time, that by the practice of certain techniques whose historical echoes I think you get in the stilling of the heart techniques of Vajrayana Buddhism, these people were able to see into the quantum mechanical foundations of thought and consciousness, and they noticed there a flux which they called the Tao. And it was a thing which came and went. The Tao Te Ching says the way that can be told of is not an unvarying way. And they stilled their body functions and they looked inward with a cataloging, analytical mentality. And they noticed that while this flux was variable, it seemed to be not infinite in its contributing factors, but that in fact it seemed to have a pattern. And they discerned the pattern as revolving around the number 64. In other words, they discerned through this process of meditation temporal elements that had a kind of ontological validity that the material elements of the periodic table have for matter. That there is not one kind of time or two kinds of time, but actually 64 facets of the possible temporal jewel. And they saw that any moment in time was the combination and the overlay of this wave system, which they call Tao, and it was a harmonic wave system. It had periods of self-expression which were very short in duration, on the order of seconds or hours or microseconds. It had levels of expression which were cognizable in the human world as years and decades and centuries, and it had vast resonant periods which were as large as history and then larger many times, periods of historical or periods of temporal resonance which could only be referenced to the life of the planet. And this is, I think, part of the Chinese notion of the Tao of heaven, earth, and man. These are different speeds at which these temporal waves of conditioning of the world of phenomenal appearance are moving. And if you take an idea like this seriously, even as a personal discipline of thought, to picture it, to visualize it in a Vajrayana spirit, then you see that what's really being offered is a map of time. It's saying that the condition of knowing a fading past and facing an unanticipatable future is not an ontologically given necessity of existence. That it is possible to imagine an existence in which one saw into time the way we as animals see into the space in front of us, so that we are able to run and leap and dance among the rocks. It's because we can see into space. A creature that, or a culture that could see into time, could anticipate where the river of time would flow quickly, where it would broaden out and move slowly with a rich sense of the conservation of accomplishments achieved, where it would cascade and break up its previous patterns and produce great cataracts of novelty. A civilization which knew these things, or a person which knew these things about their own life, would claim a new dimension of existential freedom for being. And, I was having this whispering entity, this daemon, this logos, show me these things. And it was expressed on a very, very practical level. I mapped what is called the first order of difference in the sequence of the I Ching. That means how many lines change as you go from one hexagram to another. And I discovered that it looked like a random wave. It looked like a stochastic slice, except that at the beginning and the end, there were tongue and groove points of fit if you rotated the thing 180 degrees and brought it down against itself, so that the thing achieved closure at the beginning and the end. This satisfied me that I was dealing with an artifact of nature, that I was dealing with an organized structure, either of nature or created by intelligence. And then using the principle of hierarchical resonance and stacking of modules into hierarchies, which is really the principle by which all Chinese metaphysics has operated from the very beginning, I created a cosmic calendar which had, where each level was a resonance of the level below it, but either collapsed or multiplied by a factor of 64. I discovered because the I Ching is 64 hexagrams with six lines in each hexagram, it's composed basically of 384 yao, or lines. And I discovered that this number, 384, has a very interesting property. The cycle of the moon is 29.5 days, so that if you take 29.5 times 13, it's something like 383.93. And it seemed to me then immediately obvious that part of what the machinery of the I Ching was describing in the humanly cognizable phenomenal world was the cycle of the moon using a 384-day lunar calendar which precessed 19 days a year against the solar calendar. And when you take that 384-day unit and multiply it times 64, you get 67 years and some months and days. This is exactly six 11-year sunspot cycles, and China is the first place where we have historical records of the observation of sunspots. So that's one sunspot cycle for each line in the six-line hexagram. Also, sunspot cycles have a greater peak every third cycle. So that's one large sunspot cycle for each hexagram in that trigram. And I saw then that there were these resonances. When you take that number, 67 years, again times 64, you get 4,306 years. And that works out to, 4,306, 150 years for each zodiacal sign. So it's like each zodiacal sign is slotted to one trigram. And these are all, notice that all these things that this resonance calendar is predicting are things visible to the naked eye. We're talking about movements of constellations, sunspots, and the moon. So I saw then that this was a tremendously powerful natural calendar that was a technology developed by proto-Taoist Central Asian shamanism very, very long ago. But it had this curious property of when the wave was mathematically analyzed by modern mathematical methods so that we could draw these maps of novelty, we could see then that it showed us the map of the temporal river from earliest beginnings to the collapse of the state vector at some time in the future. And so it was obvious then that if we could lay the map over the portion of reality we had already experienced, we could then propagate the map forward into the future and know and begin to take hold of ourselves in this other temporal dimension. And so it became a question of what is the best fit of this undulating wave of novelty. And I used the word novelty out of Alfred North Whitehead's philosophy, because he had this notion that novelty was the concressing of a force which knits things together. And I like that. That's what I felt it was, that the Tao is making itself. and that this compression of novelty through the speeding up of time will eventually reach a place where everything is connected to everything else. And this is, you know, the universe's self-birthing of itself. Well, you must be aware of all these very straight studies which say if we keep increasing how fast we go, by the year 2020 we'll go 10 times the speed of light. If we keep increasing how much energy we release, by so and so we'll release the energy in the sun. The propagation of all these curves of development become asymptotic, and then nobody knows how to interpret what they mean. They just seem to mean that the whole culture is going to go kazawi, you know. And this is sort of the idea that this theory implies. It implies that far from the universe being a steady state entity, uninfluenced by the existence of the human mind, which is going to go on and exist for billions of years until the stars burn out and the second law of thermodynamics is going to reduce everything to heat death, that's all wrong, 100% wrong. And that actually the universe is made by mind, within and without organism, and that mind is capable of bootstrap leaps in its organizational self-expression, and that we are privileged to be the witnesses of the final act of life going through some kind of immense transformative unfolding from itself in a kind of vortex which has been building on this planet for billions of years, but which has been accelerating to, you know, such excruciating intensities over the last 25,000 years that it has called forth self-reflective intelligence from the monkeys and the invention of quantum physics and space flight and shamanism. And it is novelty upon novelty, novelty so intensified that the genetic machinery can no longer carry it, and it bubbles out into the epigenetic, into art and language and poetry and religion and religious mania and romanticism and all of these things. It is a progressive knitting together and expression of the universe's will to become that causes me to think that we may be in the shorter gyres, as William Butler Yeats called them, the shortening spirals of this vortex of novelty and compression. You see a curious quality about this kind of cosmology that I'm describing, a cosmology where each epoch is preceded by an epoch which is a 64 times greater in duration. The curious thing about that is that you only need about 20 instances of multiplication before you go from a period of time smaller than the duration of Planck's constant, which is 1.55 times 10 to the minus 23, which is a very short period of time, to then by 20 multiplications of 64, you reach a period of time in excess of the required time for the age of the universe, a period of time on the order of 72 billion years. Well, if each time the spiral goes into a state of collapse at the end of one of its cycles, then in the last 384 days of the existence of a universe like that, it would transit through half of its epochs of transition. Do you see what I mean? It's like a screaming Mimi. It really winds up. And instead of the vision which physics gives us is that the really rapid transitions of phase and state occurred at the beginning of the universe, they whole professional lives are given over to discussing the first 10 picoseconds of the physics of the universe, right? Well, I'm saying I don't care about that. I think that the really interesting stuff will happen in a big hurry at the end of the universe, that the picture that the second law of thermodynamics gives us of just, you know, tumescence, maximum detumescence is what it's picturing, is all wrong, and that actually this strange hyperdimensional force in the universe called life and information transfer is in the process of working itself up into a real tizzy and wrapping all space and time around itself. And what was startling and what made me think that maybe I was losing my marbles was that when you look at time that way and push these novelty graphs against the historical continuum, I reached the conclusion that we entered the last 67-year period before the collapse of the state vector at 8:30 in the morning on August the 6th, 1945, when the atomic bomb went off over Hiroshima. You see, it was a temporal reflection of the birth of the universe. It was actually a, you could call it an event, which was a reincarnation of the Big Bang, because each cycle begins with a bang. And that cycle, the fact that human beings had used atomic weapons on other human beings, meant that we had entered a new era, a new epoch of moral danger, and the stakes had been raised, you know, by a power of 64 to a new level. Now, using the mathematics inherent in the cycle, if you propagate forward from that date, 67 years, 104.25 days, you reach late November of 2012 AD. And I concluded, based on all kinds of factors, personal and historical and so forth, that that was the fit. That if Hiroshima was day one, then the place where it all came together was this date in 2012. And I worked with that for several years before some kind soul, Henry Munn, I think, pointed out to me that the Mayan calendar, which is a cycle of the long count calendar I'm now talking about, is a cycle of 13 time periods, which are called baktuns. And the baktun is 396 years in duration. After 13 baktuns, the world ends completely. And the 13th baktun of the classical Mayan long count calendar is the winter solstice of AD 2012. Within 30 days of the date that I had fastened in on using a completely different path of analysis. And so this raised all kinds of questions, one of which is it simply that individuals and civilizations who take mushrooms become, I want to say, privy slash engulfed by a certain mathematical secret about the cosmic machinery? What is so important about this date in 2012? You know, the Mesoamerican cultures have the most uncanny history of successful prophecy in the world. I mean, the Aztecs anticipated the coming of the Spanish. The day, the Book of Chilambelam gives the day when the Spaniards would weigh anchor off the coast of Mexico. And of course, the fact that it happened exactly as prophesized was a major undoing of that civilization. So I put this out. This was a very confusing experience for me to channel or transmit this idea, because I was interested in the I Ching. I had carried it with me in India. I used to throw it at each full moon, but I was not mathematically inclined. And when reading the philosophy of science, and people like Paul Feyerabend and Imre Lakatos, and reading the history of science, and Thomas Kuhn and all of those people trying to understand, you know, well, what is a true idea? What is true and what is false? And when you have an idea which makes claims as sweeping as these, then you want to try to understand just what the limits of knowability are. And I discovered that all you can require of any idea is that it be self-consistent, that it not generate any contradictions within its own set of rules, you see. And that's why astrology is beyond criticism, because astrology is a mathematical theory with an interpretive exegesis attached to it. And who can quibble with the mathematical theory? Well, then interpretational exegesis has to do with the sensitivity and subtlety of the interpreter. Well, isn't this true of mathematical data in science exactly the same way? So I discovered that what I had created was a self-consistent idea that appears to be sealed beyond refutation in some weird and uncanny way, which makes it seem very non-human, because you can't really find your way into telling whether it's can be answerable to the notion of objective truth. So what I've decided about it is that it's a teaching, or it's an exemplary model about how all process goes on, and it's a way of learning how things happen, to see time as a modulated flux of elements, to see it as a series of waves moving at different speeds through which you are taking a vertical slice and then stacking that slice. And that gives rise to the multiplistic, ever-changing flux that is called the now. It is actually made up of reflections and adumbrations of the past. And it's made up of anticipatory shock waves and intimations of the future. The past and the future are co-present in the now. They are, in fact, what's making it happen. You can almost think of it as a hologram, where you have two, or a standing wave, where you have two wave systems, one from the past, one from the future, and where they cross, an interference pattern forms, which has a curious stability as a system in and of itself. And yet it's almost a ghost created by these other two realities. And that is the moving present. And mathematically, this notion of time that I evolved delivers, you know, the map of novelty, a two-variable flux, a wandering line graph that's very pleasing for arguing with formalists. But what lurks behind it, and what is so rich for the romantic and the shaman and the poet, is this wandering line graph is the composite of the overlay of certain historical time periods, which are in a state of flux at various speeds, so that they give rise to an endless kaleidoscopic unfolding in what we call three-dimensional space and of what we call reality. And this is why I often mention Finnegan's Wake in my lectures, because Joyce understood this. He understood that every moment is caused by everything that happened in the past and everything that happened in the future. And I like to give, you know, the trivial example that you find yourself in Hadrian's hamburger joint. This is because the Emperor Hadrian invaded England in a certain year and conducted a campaign. We are ghosts of past and future events. And what the chaos at the end of history that we are now living through is that for thousands and thousands of years, people have felt a vague thing calling across time to humanness, calling us to be a certain way, to practice certain rituals, to observe the stars, to observe the plants, to observe birth and observe death, a calling. And that thing, which some people have called God, whatever it is throwing a gigantic shadow over human history now, because now the creed of development that leads to our merging with this thing, the walls are very steep. The water is moving very swiftly, and it's almost as though the future event is throwing off great sparks that are themselves faceted, contradictory epitomizations of this mystery. This is what Muhammad and Christ and Buddha are. They are human personalities that were situated in time in such a way that they became macrocosmic reflections of the superordinate endemic humanity that is going to be generated at the end of history. And we are close. We are close. It is all of history can be seen as the shockwave of this eschatological event. This is what the prophets were anticipating, the culmination of man's God-making effort in time will be the perfection and the release of the human soul. And it's not that we are doing it, you see. It's that a natural law that we were previously unaware of is inexorably unfolding. And that is what all this cross-connectedness of man into matter, plant into animal, earth into space, all of this flowing and interconnectedness, this reaches right down into the rocks of the planet. This is not simply a phenomenon of biology. This is the unfolding of a general law of which biology is only the cutting edge of a wedge of becomingness which includes all being and reaches right down into the neutrinos. And it is, to be a being in time is to share in the immense flood of precognitive anticipation that fills the universe in anticipation of this event. And that's what being is, and that's why it's so rich and so complete within itself, and yet always somehow pointing beyond itself, because the richness of the matrix through which we are moving is incomparable and beautiful. And so this is the basis of my extreme optimism, is I think that everything is under control, that we are in the grip of a force so powerful that the notion that we could jeopardize or overthrow it is completely preposterous. Because we are acting in accordance with a resonance that was set going millions and millions of years ago. And of course, being is fraught with danger, but the stakes are, to be at play in the fields of the Lord, to be at rest in the mansions of the goddess, and it's soon, I think, at least the historical mimicking of it is clearly soon, because the thrust toward the millennium of this society will not be turned aside. If it is not a law of the universe, then it will become a myth of human beings and be created anyway. So, since we are human beings, I see us as the central actors in that mandala. I mean, this is the task of the next 100 or 500 years, to realize the alchemical nature of humanity and being, and have everything fused into a supernumerous concrescence that is time. Joyce said, all space in a nutshell. You know, all time bound into a lenticular vehicle, which is both everyone's and mine alone, and yours alone, and yours alone.